Survivor injustice, state-sanctioned abuse, domestic violence, and the fight for bodily autonomy by Kylie Chung. Narrated by Dana Wing Lau. Published by North Atlantic Books. Introduction. When my sisters and I were growing up, our parents would tell us stories of grandparents and great-grandparents and great-aunts nearly sold away as child brides, stories of young women of previous generations who were accorded no power, worth, or determinism in their marriages and in society at large. They told us these stories for the same reason immigrant parents often tell their children family stories, to not so subtly guilt us into gratitude for our comparably much cushier lives. At the time, I didn't make too much of family lore, but now and then, I found myself mentally returning to the story of my mom's grandmother, who had locked herself in a closet for days as a teenager to escape marriage to an older, abusive man. It's a story I continue to think about today. All these stories I heard as I spent my formative years coming of age in a quiet Silicon Valley suburb. Like many of my peers, throughout high school, I struggled to keep my head above water amid a pervasive mental health crisis across schools like mine. On top of the at times debilitating pressure to achieve academic perfection, if such a thing is possible, when I was 16, I also struggled to care for myself and navigate the trauma of experiencing sexual assault, starting with even acknowledging what had happened to me. Eventually, through years of reflection, campus anti-rape activism, and learning from and healing with others who have survived sexual violence, I came to meditate on the unique experience of Asian American victims and survivors like me. And as I did, the stories my mom once told me became more real, less distant. Stories of a great aunt, now deceased, whose husband was physically abusive if she gave too much money to their church or to unhoused community members, and controlled her spending and access to a car. Stories of another aunt whose husband stopped her from volunteering in the community and later from leaving the house. Eventually, the individual anecdotes of relatives both distant and close, sexually abused as girls, beaten or controlled as wives, blended into one greater story, a pattern, a broader culture of normalized domestic violence. Drawing on my own experience as well as the stories of women in my family, I've witnessed how Asian American survivors are forced to navigate a difficult space. We face cultural erasure from the whitewashing of dialogues about sexual violence and victimhood. We face the hyper-sexualization of Asian American feminine identity in white and Western spaces. And we face the often conservative, sex-shaming politics of immigrant households at home and in our communities. These dynamics can expose Asian American victims to intensified victim blaming and certainly force many to hide our pain and struggle within a culture of silence and invisibility. Stereotyping and fetishization of Asian women originate from Western imperialist conquest in the Pacific throughout the 19th and 20th centuries that resulted in the trafficking and rape of thousands of Asian women, inspiring persistent, targeted violence against us. In March 2021, a white man went on a shooting rampage, exclusively targeting Asian massage parlors in Atlanta, Georgia, and killing six Asian women, and explained to police that they were a temptation to him and his sexual addiction. He had targeted the women because of his perception of them as sex workers, a conclusion he drew from their race and class as Asian women's service workers. Other violent acts against Asian women, which have seen a pointed surge since the 2020 COVID pandemic, are erased by model minority mythology that sweeps anti-Asian oppressions under the rug and silences victims of abuse. I'll never forget how I felt when, in the fall of 2019, Chanel Miller published her simultaneously devastating and healing memoir, Know My Name, recounting her experience as the plaintiff in the notorious Stanford rape case of 2016, which saw Brock Turner, a white man, jailed for 3 months for raping Miller. Specifically, I'll never forget seeing Miller's face in her 2019-2020 interview. My shock when I realized she was an Asian American woman and not a white woman. I'll never forget reading about her family like mine, her schooling and upbringing in a Bay Area suburb like mine, her grandparents like mine, her school's mental health crisis like mine. Her identity forced me to question my instincts and my own whitewashed assumptions, and why nearly all the victims we hear about or are socialized to sympathize with are middle-class white women. Miller's story also made me consider other narratives and preconceived notions about sexual abuse and society, about anonymity, race, gender, class, about the heard and the unheard stories of violence and exploitation, and the differences between them. Her story prompted me to recognize my identity as not just an Asian woman and a survivor separately, but an Asian woman survivor. And it made my once isolating lived experience with sexual violence less lonely. The most visible victims of abuse are middle-class, straight, cisgender white women. Yet it's women of color, queer women, and trans and non-binary people who are more likely to experience sexual and domestic violence, and who are subjected to greater pressure to be silent due to fear of hostility and punishment from law enforcement, and who lack resources and support to protect themselves or be independent from abusers. Jennifer Kelly, a Black woman and U.S. Navy veteran, reported her white ex-husband in the Air Force for physically abusing her 3 young daughters and herself, at one point allegedly sexually assaulting her with a knife, and subsequently lost custody of them and faces criminal charges in Alaska for briefly running away with her daughters in 2020. Today, a restraining order prohibits her from even contacting her daughters. In an interview with me in 2020, Kelly insisted that stories like mine are not uncommon. As an Asian American woman and a journalist, activist, and author, I've researched and reported on rape culture, feminism, public policy, and racial justice for almost a decade. My reporting has spanned from an emergent new wave of campus survivor justice organizing in the early 2010s to the rise and persistence of the mainstream Me Too movement in 2017. The COVID-era crises of heightened domestic violence, the swell of violent attacks on Asian women since 2020, and both most recently and perhaps most devastatingly, the overturning of Roe v. Wade, empowering the state to become the ultimate abuser in 2022. Within mere days of Roe being overturned and the wave of state abortion bans that followed, Republican lawmakers were making threats to ban birth control, Plan B, and IVF methods. Amid an ongoing legal battle to block Louisiana's abortion ban from taking effect post-Roe, one woman was forced to endure a painful, hours-long delivery to birth a dead fetus because the ban temporarily went into effect and her doctor wasn't allowed to provide a simple 15-minute abortion procedure. Months before this, an abortion ban in Texas forced one woman to carry a dead fetus for 2 weeks after doctors refused to give her emergency care out of fear they could be bankrupted by lawsuits as a result of Texas's civilly enforced 6-week ban, placing her at risk of severe infection and death. A week after Roe fell, a 10-year-old rape victim in Ohio was forced to travel across state lines to get abortion care in Indiana because she was slightly more than 6 weeks pregnant, in violation of Ohio's newly minted ban. What followed was a gutting, dehumanizing media circus of politicians and legacy newspapers claiming the tragic story was a hoax, perpetuated by abortion rights activists, implicitly questioning a child rape victim's credibility. Indiana's attorney general announced he would investigate and possibly prosecute the doctor who had offered the child abortion.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?